You're listening to Two Guys Talking Wine with Michael Pincus and Andre Prue.
Hello, Michael.
Andre, how are you?
I'm a little anxious right now.
Why is that?
One of the reasons we switched to biweekly for this podcast was to avoid some of the, like, nonsense episodes that we've put out. And, I mean, that's the thing where, like, if we go back into the library, like, I think we call them the shooting the it episodes where, like, I'm sure we talked about some stuff, but, man. Well,
we sooner or later come to a topic, yeah.
But they are definitely not our best work.
Some of them are fun to listen to, though, I think. Although, what I'm assuming you're getting at is that you're trying to tell people that is what they are about to listen to. But on the other hand, we did have our annual board meeting, which means we both sit around and look bored, but we talk about things. And we talked about what is going to come up on the podcast this year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of exciting. And we're going to get some new artwork within the next couple of months. So that's, you know, something to look forward to. And we are going to explore. I don't know if I should be dropping what we're looking at doing. Should we drop some of the stuff?
Yeah, I mean, why not? So, I mean, without further ado, here is the first Shooting the It podcast and hopefully the last Shooting the It podcast of 2024. And I think we can do a little bit of a mea culpa on this. Like, you've been traveling quite a bit. I'm doing some more work. I'm now working with Canada Land again, and that's the outlet that I did the episode last year unpacking the state of wine writing and the investigation on Carolyn Evans Hammond, episode 920 of Canada Land, if anyone hasn't heard it. So,
and it was our 251. No, what was it for us? What episode was one of our episodes too, where you just we talked about
further detail. Yeah, I guess it's about 10 episodes ago. Yeah, now it came out in September 2023.
Back a little bit, and you'll find it there as well. But we had a kind of a planning meeting, kind of over breakfast. And discuss what was going to come up this year, hopefully on the podcast. We've had some pretty good interviews. We're looking at a couple more.
Yeah.
People remember a few episodes back, we did something on Cyprus.
Yes.
And then you did a little call out. You said, you know what, what I'd really like to do is try some of these wines and talk to somebody with a little more knowledge than me. Grant, I was only there a week, obviously, so I garnered some knowledge. But there's got to be, you know, there's going to be tons of guys who are in Cyprus. And as it turns out, one of the Cypriot wine makers heard your call out, emailed me and said, I'll send you the wine and I would love to be on the podcast if you'll have me. And I said, absolutely. So at some point we will be getting 5 Cypriot wines and we will get this guy on the podcast.
Can I call you out on something though?
Yeah.
And I didn't want to respond to your post that you put on Instagram just because I didn't want you to think that I was being bitchy. But you called me out on my Cypress Hill jokes when you posted the promo for the podcast.
Well, you put that in the promo in the in the podcast.
The show notes. Yes.
And I just copied the show notes.
You did not.
I did too.
You did not.
Yeah.
So here's the question I want to put. I want to put to the people. Here's the question I want to put.
I copied the show notes and made them more relevant for Instagram.
Here's the question I want to put to the people who listen to this podcast. Which joke is better? My Cypress Hill jokes or your stupid, crazy about a Mercury joke that you make every time we talk about?
On the other hand, you have just biased the audience. Because
I called it stupid?
Correct. Because your moronic Cypress Hill joke.
There we go. Now we're even.
Was not as good as my ultimately hardcore crazy about a Mercury. Because that's baller. Because you can be crazy about a Mercury. Because it's, you know, a car. And it is also.
It's not spelt the same way. Exactly like Cypress and Cypress.
But Mercury could be spelled the same.
Whatever, Michael. You're insane in the membrane.
So. So that was one thing. And then, you know, the other one that we found out that the friend of the podcast, Penelope Irving,
mm-hmm.
is sadly left Family Wine Merchant and is now working for Partake Brewing.
Actually, did you get a lot of response in your DMs after our Dry January episode? Because I had quite a bit of response in mine.
Well, no, because I made fun of your Dry January. How was your response to that?
I think it was just a lot of people, and I think this might be a demographic thing, like, because it is one of the things where, factually speaking, fewer millennials and Gen Z are drinking. They're drinking less, drinking better. The non-alcoholic category is blowing up. And like, I had some people reach into my inbox to talk about, A, like the concept of non-alcoholic beer and setting up for alternatives for Dry January. And like, just like where non-alcoholic beer is, which is why I'm excited for where we're going with Penelope. So Penelope is now working with Partake Brewing.
And I when she told me that, I was like, well, okay, let's dive a little deeper.
Yeah.
Let's, if you know, we got somebody who's on the in, let's talk to her. Because I am not into the alcoholic beer. I did not like the beers that we tried that evening.
Well, it was just the one. It was the compliments one. And yeah, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing how things go. Like it's the thing where, and I talked to you about this when we talked about this on the phone about this and what we were going to do, is like, your critique was not incorrect. Like, it's near beer. It's not beer. And like there was stuff missing from it. But I think one thing we could probably be in agreement on is that non-alcoholic beer is in a much better place than non-alcoholic wine.
Yeah, I would give you that. The non-alcoholic wines I've tasted are just grape juice. That's it. And I don't know why we just don't call it grape juice. I remember when I was growing up, there used to be this thing called Sarasota, and it had 0.5% alcohol and could be sold in a corner store. I liked the taste of it. I don't even remember what it tasted like. I liked the taste of it. I knew that I wasn't going to get drunk off of 0.5% alcohol, and I wasn't going, ooh, I'm going to buy this because it's got 0.5% alcohol. I actually enjoyed whatever the taste was that it was. I remember it was being kind of a fruity drink of some sort. If anybody remembers what the taste of Sarasota was, go right ahead and throw it out there, because I'd love to know what the hell I was drinking. You know, that to me had a flavor, and I think just a byproduct of it was that it had 0.5%. Knowing what beer tastes like,
I think we need to step off, because this is definitely content that would be part of a podcast we're doing with Penelope. So I thought what we might do is just open a few wines. There's some stuff that's kicking around in my basement. We'd have a bit of a conversation. Maybe it is a little self-serving. I opened up the 2021 Damn Chardonnay, because I know you haven't tasted it since we bottled it.
You got a nice acid core here.
Yeah.
Is this for sale yet, or mm-hmm. it's okay? So it is for sale, and this is the finished product. You're happy with this product?
I am.
Okay.
Yeah, we're selling it for $30 a bottle. It's already in some pretty interesting restaurants, like La Bartola in Toronto is pouring this right now, which I'm pretty chuffed about. It's a vegan Mexican restaurant where the food's amazing.
I liked your 2020 better, say that. This one's good. Yeah, it's all right.
I'll send the bottle home with you, and you can
and watch
live with that for a bit. What this wine has that I think the 2020 is missing is a little bit of depth and like mineral. Like I find for me, there's a minerality to this that was missing in 2020, and you don't normally find in the like sandy soils of Niagara-on-the-Lake.
Surprisingly, I'm finding like a grilled peach pineapple note to it that I would not have thought for 2021. How about that? How weird that becomes.
Hand sorting.
And yeah. And then you brought out this bottle.
Yep. So we got a package from Colmena. And Colmena, back when like Don Triggs and Sarah Triggs were working at it, like those were eyebrow raising wines. I was very excited, like when we did get packages from Colmena. Like I remember Hypothesis from the onset being just great, and like,
and when we did the tasting with Don,
when we did tasting with Sarah too.
Yeah, when we did the tasting with Don and with Sarah, both of them brought some pretty interesting wines. Ever since they sold it back to Artera, and I'm sorry, Artera, these have been terrible. I don't know what, like, The package contained, I didn't mind, you were not as chuffed about the, I liked the sparkling, which
I
had a little.
The sparkling was terrible.
And I didn't mind the Gruner. I thought the Gruner had some Gruner characteristics.
The sparkling was made with Cab Franc.
It was a mix of stuff, but there was some Cab Franc in there.
And it was underripe AF. Like, it was like, I don't understand, like, for someone who's as critical of underripe Cab Franc as you, I'm surprised you had anything good to say about that wine. Like, it was like asparagus juice.
But, I mean, it tasted better than anything else that came out of that box. And so I was...
Yeah, but that's not an excuse to give them a pass on it. And so we just opened the Chardonnay.
From Kaltman.
I was saving it because I do, like, I don't mind BC Chardonnay. And this is, like, once again, like a shout out to Christine Campbell as well, where... You know, I'm still struggling to find the super duper memorable BC Chardonnays. This, you know, I look at it, it makes sense to me. Like, when I grab this, I see 14.0% on the back of the bottle. Like, that makes sense. I know where in the Okanagan Culmina is located. So I expect this to be a little warm. I put it in my glass. It's got that cream corn nose that I really enjoy from California. And I was just like, okay, so this is going to be a fruit bomb. Like, let's put it in the mouth. And then in the mouth, it tastes like burnt wood. It tastes like the smell of like charred firewood after you've poured water on it.
It's way too woody. And before I get too far into the rest of the box from Culmina, I had on tour yesterday some folks from British Columbia who were experiencing Ontario for the first time, and they told me they hate Chardonnay. And I said, is this because you're from British Columbia? She said, yeah, we just like to support local. And we ended up going to Flat Rock.
Nice.
And we went to, I can't remember the first place. Oh, we went to Calamus, Good Earth. Anyway, she did mention that the Chardonnays were much more approachable from Ontario. And that's, you know, obviously you get into the idea of the acidity and the cooler climate and all that. But yes, they said they just hated BC Chardonnay because they were just Chateau 2x4. And I don't want to crap all over Culmina, but I mean, they sent a Malbec, they sent a Cabernet, they sent three reds, three whites.
They were undrinkable.
They were terrible.
The reds were undrinkable. And like, that's the first time I've had to say that. And it's just like, you know, how the mighty have fallen. Like, I don't understand what's going on there.
And we're
seeing a world. Like, we're seeing a world where globally, people are pulling back on wood. Use of new oak. We're seeing...
Having just come back from Italy, like, they are using, in their, you know, reserve quality wines, they are told to leave them in wood for X number of months, 24, 36, 30 months. And you see that because wineries want to, you know, have a reserve line, but they don't want to have so much wood, that they're buying, they're either using really old wood or they're using much larger barrels so that the wood to juice ratio is much less. And so you don't get the wood characteristics in the wine.
Whereas Culmina seems to be
jumping right on board with this. Wood, I guess Culmina is buying all the new wood.
But it's even... Like, I think one thing we will see enter more the mainstream thought process of as the conversation about wood and wine evolves is the way the wood is treated. I think to a lesser extent, the forest. And that's one thing where if you talk to especially the Chardonnay winemakers in Niagara, like the forest is becoming part of the conversation. But the way the wood is treated, how long it's toasted, how dark it's toasted, and
sometimes not even toasted at all. These steam bent barrels are interesting.
That sounds like that'd be risky to me, because you still get, then you would have the risk of pyrazine from an untoasted barrel, right?
Correct. But you get a naked steam bent barrel that, you know, obviously you have to put something through it first. I know a lot of people that I talked to were like putting water through it first, trying, you know, soak some of that wood tannin out of it originally.
For the
so that water comes out almost yellow.
For the ADX Wine Company, we bought a brand new barrel for the first time this year. And we bought a Dammy barrel that was a lightly toasted, long toast. And we put some Chardonnay in it we're running two Chardonnays through it in the first year. The first one was in it for like 3 months, and that 225 liters of wine in 3 months slurped up a lot of that oak flavoring. And like, we're really lucky, and we're lucky to have like Adam as a really competent winemaker to build balance in the wine, to have, to make sure that that is a component of a larger piece. And like, we're not working with a lot of fruit. Like sometimes we're making, like our Chardonnays are 2-barrel or 3-barrel lots. So, you know, we're being super careful with that. Like a new barrel, it is insane how much flavor comes out of it in such a short amount of time.
So, I'm just going to come right in to say it. I think Kalmanen needs to find a new winemaker, because the guy's in love with oak, or he's been given the mandate to run.
But that's the thing, though, is the love of oak. It doesn't make sense with what I expect from the brand. Like, that's the thing, is someone who's been following this brand for quite some time now, you know, I expect Hypothesis to be a little bit more extracted. I expect Hypothesis to be a bigger red wine. I expect Hypothesis to be that really Okanagan, that halfway point between the new world and the old world. And what's happening there feels so out of touch with the way consumers are buying wine, especially younger consumers are buying wine. I have a hard time imagining that brand heading for long-term success with the way the wine's being made right now.
So, I'm in total agreement on you on that. So let's move on from that. I don't want to keep crapping all over somewhere, but so you've just poured the first red of the day. Smells kind of Pinot-ish.
Oh, okay. So we're gonna blind this. I'll tell you what it is. It's good. It was actually a gift from one of the listeners of this podcast.
That's nice. Well, that's all right. What is it?
What is it?
Yeah.
This is a Benjamin Bridge Gaspereau Valley 2020 Pinot Noir Reserve.
Oh, so I got Pinot Noir. Okay, good.
12% alcohol.
Yeah, it's not overly alcohol. It's not. It's got, you know, notes of fruit. Okay. It's got pretty, got notes of some fruit, a little more darker than lighter red fruits.
A little stemmy, like it's not underripe, but
I'm not offended by it in any way, shape, or form.
I just realized one of the problems with my my dining table that we're sitting at right now. I painted the tabletop blue. Like I like how the blue works with the red of my carpet and like the red accents I have on the wall. But I was looking at the wine and I was just like, there's almost like a blue tinge to it. And I realized, no, it's just the wine's so pale that the blue from the paint on the table is coming through.
Yeah,
that's
a good point. Yeah, I put my fingers behind it. Yeah, it's pretty. It's pretty light. It's Pinot. There's no doubt about it.
Yep.
And I know that we're going to be going through some more of these wines at a later date.
Yes. So we were given a care package from Hunter, who is a chef on Prince Edward Island, regular listener to the podcast, and has been. I've had him over for dinner a couple of times now, and he has been very gracious to connect us with these Nova Scotian wines. So there's actually a full case in the basement. It's just knowing that we didn't really have a firm topic today, I just went to the basement and
grabbed a couple
of things to see what was what. And
so maybe we'll do another, we'll do a Nova Scotia kind of a deep dive into the wines. We know very little about, you know, what the agricultural mess is over there.
Yeah. So I just needed to pull up his Instagram account to make sure that I got his name correct. It's Hunter Guindon, Guindon. I'm sure I'm a French guy, and I'm having a hard time with your last name. So, Hunter, I know you're listening to this. I'm really, really sorry about
Guindon?
Guindon. Let's just stop before we
make a whole mess of it. Yeah, no, I'm...
This is yummy.
Yeah, I'm happy with that. I have no problem with that.
Especially after the Kalmanen.
It's not overly woody. It's not overly... it's not overly extracted. There is some fine tannin to that wine. I'm assuming that 2020 was pretty good all over Canada.
Alcohol's only 12% on it, though, right?
So... Yeah, but they have a cool. They have a much cooler climate than we have to begin with. So ripening things like Pinot and Chardonnay out there, there's a reason why Benjamin Bridge makes, you know, sparkling wine.
Speaking of which, I put one in the freezer
that
will likely be ready just now. But before I go grab that bottle, is there anything? Because like I know this is one where like we've done the Anteprima. Like you went to the Anteprima Toscana again this year, as you do every year. And like we've done quite a few podcasts on this, and it's just one of these things where like I've decided I need to find a way to get to Tuscany. Like I've been trying to kind of stumble my way through it on my own. I enjoy Chianti Classico, but I enjoy Chianti Classico at that entry level price. Like I don't mind spending like $20-$25 like when I go to vintages, just when I want something that's not Ontario. You know, it's got a cool climate vibe to it. But like, you know, after that trip to Burgundy last summer where I really feel that like I had my brain opened and it was crammed full of the knowledge I've been trying to figure out, I don't think I'll ever really understand Tuscany until I make my way there.
Make the pilgrimage.
But is there anything that you want to add, or is there anything that you think that you could throw at me in like a bite-sized piece that I might understand a bit better now that we've done it a few times and had the conversation a few times?
Well, Chianti is about to get more complicated because they're throwing out the sub-appellations as everybody seems to be doing these days. So I don't know if there's really any way to encapsulate what Chianti means other than, you know, yeah, Andre, that's a really good question. And I'm a little bit, I could tell you what vintages are good. I can tell you, that the Grand Selections have slowly started to, get away again.
Oh, the Ruffino Grand Selezione that we tasted last fall on a podcast that 100% was not paid for. That was my favorite Grand Selezione that I've tasted so far, because often the Grand Selezione that make its way to my house, and it's not a lot of them for review. Like vanilla has become
so
a really big part of like what I expect.
So the interesting part about the Grand Selezione as of, I think it's 2027. I think that's when it finally comes into effect. But you're going to see a lot more Grand Selezione because one of the stipulations that some of the winemakers made from some of the smaller houses was they didn't want to make Grand Selezione because it wasn't all indigenous grapes. Like it could be Sangiovese and a little bit of something else.
Okay.
And you could put Cab Sauv or Franc or Merlot into it. And a lot of them were like, well, that's, you know, why are we doing that with our high-end wine when we, you know, should be highlighting our own indigenous grape varieties? And so, as I said, I believe it's going to be 2027, all Grand Selezione have to be.
So it's kind of like really drawing a line in the sand to make sure that Chianti Classico and IGT are like completely uncoupled.
Yes, I think they're trying to get away. Well, in Chianti, you can still use, you know, some Cab, but for Grand Selezione, it's become a line in the sand for a lot of producers that they do not want to have Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot or international varieties in those wines. And then so now you're seeing either 100% Cabernet Sauvignon, you get a little bit of Colorino, you get a little bit of Canaiolo. You get those indigenous varieties of Italy going into them as the blend instead of, 90% Sangiovese and 10% Cabernet Sauvignon. So that's going to make those wines stand out as being unique and different. And you're going to see some really small producers now making a Grand Selezione. You're also seeing them being a lot, as mentioned earlier, that they are backing off on wood. So you get a lot of that vanilla that you were mentioning.
Yeah.
So you're noticing that, again, these small producers that came out, you know, this year with their Grand Selezione, they were a lot more approachable, ageable, but still approachable.
Yep.
Because they also didn't want to overwhelm with wood. And so it really is a global trend to get away from new wood, And if you are doing new wood, it's kind of very similar to what Adam was doing, you know, 3 months in and then, you know, pull it out. So if you have to do that for a year, just pass a wine through a new oak barrel for 3 months, for 2 months, just to season that oak and get it a little older, then you're going to do it, as opposed to just leaving it in there for a, you know, whole year of new wood treatment.
Yep.
And it's a kind of a global trend that I like.
Me too.
Which makes me wonder, you know, why a certain generation got away from wine. Maybe they didn't like that parkerization of wine and they got away from it. It makes you
I'm not sure if that's the case, though.
Alcohol thing or, but I mean,
no, if, but that's the thing though, is, you know, if I ever have the time, like I would love to formalize some sort of study on this though, because like I find, especially among my friends who are getting wine curious that haven't taken the, like the formal wine knowledge. So they're just people who like wine, know that they like wine. Like there's two places people gravitate to pretty quickly once they get over the, like the baseline entry level, like, you know, the cellared in Canada or the like wine cooler phase, is like, for my generation, it was a lot of Argentinian Malbec and New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. And like my theory about these two places is it you feel sophisticated drinking them because when you read the shelf stalker, it's easy to detect the tasting notes that are written on the shelf stalker, right? Yep. Like when you open up a bottle of Pinot, like this 12% Pinot that we just opened, I think to a lot of new wine drinkers, they would consider this to be sour or tart because of the high acid in it. And if we said, okay, well, violet, dark cherry, red cherry, pencil cranberry, pencil shavings, violet, forest floor, like these are things where it's a little bit harder to sit and really detect those without a lot of practice or a lot of experience, which is it's like, I guess, sort of unfortunate. But yeah, you get to these regions where it's easy, where like you pick up a bold bottle of affordable Malbec and it's just like, you know, black fruit, juicy. And it's just like, okay, like this tastes exactly like the back of the bottle. Like that makes sense.
Yeah, I get that. But
this is where I'm not sure I agree with the parkerizations, because the thing is, picking up a juicy Napa Valley that's still like parkerized, you know, over extracted, jammy, cooked fruit, is like, these are easy wines to understand. I think that's why like Camus has become the like 10 gram per liter abomination that it's become.
I've also thought that maybe it's just, you know, people tried too much wood, and then as wood is being backed off upon and fruit is starting to become more center stage, the question becomes, you know, why isn't wine more popular? Because it now tastes more like wine. And is it because people have tried something that you know, was thrust upon them? I've always had the theory that people don't like wine or a certain wine is because they had a certain wine thrust on them too early. Such as when you're really young and you have, let's say, an uncle who is like, you know, big into wine, and he's like, you got to try this Bordeaux, kid. This is really wine. And you get like this 20-year-old Bordeaux and you don't understand wine at all. And you get this 20-year-old Bordeaux and you're like, I don't get it. It tastes sour. It's just terrible. I don't want to drink that. You know, it's old fruit, blah, blah, blah. Then you're probably not in. Or you get something that's over.
See, but I had the opposite experience. Like, the wine that got me into wine was Wolf Blass Yellow Label.
Like, a lot of people got into wine for Wolf Blass Yellow Label.
But I was 18 years old.
Correct.
And that's what my parents were drinking in the house. And the thing is, like, I still maintain...
But that was a soft, juicy, easy drinking wine.
And it was dry. And it wasn't too tannic.
But that's the kind of wine that gets people into wine and maybe gets them wine curious. Wolf Blass was probably the last really high quality, you know, mass selling wine, like at the LCBO anyway, because after that we got into Yellowtail, then you got into Little Penguin, and then you became with Fusion, and then you got into Toro Bravo, you know, all of these wines that were just, you know, they weren't, I'm not saying they're not seriously made, but they're seriously made to be drank young, easy, and almost too easy. Wolf Blass was, they're a serious wine company. The other ones were manufactured to be drink now wines.
Well, and it's the other thing about millennials and Gen Z, though, is like we are still the experienced generation. And like there's more and more articles coming out about that where, like, with regards to employment, the whole concept of company loyalty doesn't exist with my generation. And I love reading articles like this and reading comments on them because it's often Gen X and baby boomers who are once again shitting on our generation because we've decided that we want to work to live, not live to work, right? I think I got those right, but it's the whole idea.
Sounded right to me.
After you know, 13 years at Bell Media with no raises and no opportunities for advancement, I'm never going to do that for another company ever again. And frankly, like, you've seen the changes that I've made in my life over the past couple of years, is that I find work that I enjoy. I don't let it define me, but I'm finding ways to do what I want to do, whether that's opening a bakery in Hamilton, which, by the way, I've done since the last podcast. You know, I guess tying this back to wine is, it's just like, I don't think our generation, my generation, people who are into, really into food and wine and really into the farm to table, which is not a trend anymore, which is a part of how we choose to make our buying decisions. We don't want to be fleeced by a company like Yellowtail that's essentially manufacturing Coca-Cola. We would rather spend the extra money to get a bottle of Zante's Footsteps and eventually a bottle of Clonakilla if we're going to drink Australian wine and drink less and better, knowing that this is wine made by a farmer, wine that is being made with care, and wine that's ending up in the bottle. And, you know, I think the natural wine movement that we've seen, especially for the younger generation, is a bit of a canary in the coal mine. And I do think we're starting to see some people pull back a bit. I've heard some people who were acolytes of the Grape Witches now opening wines that they've had in their cellars. And it's more than one. It's been two people that have had the experience, because you and I are skeptical of trendy winemaking, which I think is important. And I think I go into things a little bit more open-eyed when I see what trends are coming, but trends are trends for a reason. And we're starting to see things pull back. And like when we talked to Xavier in January, like, the way Xavier talks about natural wine is the way natural wine should be approached. For him, it's not a trend. For him, it's about the quality of the product.
It's not a lifestyle. It is the way wine, he believes, should be made. And I saw him again this time in Italy. He was at the Bologna Slow Wine Fair. And, you know, it's amazing. I tasted his wines again under different circumstances, and they were still really good. And you know who's, you know, at the heart of slow wine, like, because I believe it started there, is Piedmont. And okay. Barolos and Barbarescos and wines that are Nebbiolos and Barberas. You know, those wines are good.
Because they're good.
Solid wines, because they're good. Not because they're a trend, not because they're chasing slow wine or raw wine. They are just good wines. And when the moment you start chasing a trend, I think that's when everything starts to go to hell.
I've seen it in some of my conversations at farmers markets, is we now have a generation of wine professionals that's palates are calibrated to gravitate towards faults. And I think that's going to be a problem probably for the next 5 to 10 years that I think will correct itself, because, you know, I actually had someone, when they opened up one of the wines that they'd purchased from one of the Grape Witches packages, and they were just like, what was I thinking when I bought this, is how the conversation went. This tastes like body odor, is the tasting note that they gave me on the wine. And it's just like,
I've spoken to a number of people on this topic. One of the ones I remember is, as you know, I also inventory wine cellars, and one of these guys is out there, and he's tasted a lot of wine in his day. You know, he buys a lot of wine. He's tasted a lot of wine. He no longer trusts sommeliers. And the reason he doesn't trust them is because he's like, you know, he wants to explore, but he says to them, give me something in this price range that I'm really going to enjoy. And three bottles come to the table, and he tries all three, and he's just sending them back. He goes, this is not palatable. Why do you give me something I can drink? And I think that's where we are. I think sommeliers are, you know, jumping the shark, in my opinion, and some of these wines that they're getting behind, and you're now seeing consumers, not all of them, but you are seeing consumers fight back on this, and they're like, well, this is not what I want to drink anymore. And I'm also seeing a lot of winemakers now, even in Europe, saying this orange wine, this skin, you know, skin fermented wine, it's such a trend that we don't want to touch with a 10-foot pole. And they don't even use the term orange wine. They'll do a little bit of skin fermentation, but not to the point where it ruins the wine. They want to give it some flavor. They want to give it some, but they're not looking for the orange color. When I was in Cyprus, I tasted a wine, and the guy had finally admitted that yes, there was skin contact, but it was still, you know, a pale yellow. It had skin contact for, you know, just maybe a week, if that.
Well, hopefully a move away from dogmatic winemaking is something we're going to see more and more. Because I actually had a skin contact Pinot Gris from Alsace last fall when I went to see Danko Jones. And, you know, given how you and I have been quite critical of the style, I enjoyed it down to the last drop.
So skin contact is right in Pinot Gris. The interesting part is the flavor comes from the skins in Pinot Gris, as far as I've been able to figure out. And I sat once in on a master class on one winery who was very, very bullish on how they had led the trend to get the pink or the copper color out of Pinot Gris. And I was like,
Why? Yeah.
Because every time I taste a Pinot Gris with some of that copperish color, with there that it's gone a little on the pink side, it actually has got flavor to it. Because I believe Pinot Gris gets that flavor from the skin, because otherwise
Remember that Pinot Gris that Cassaba made? It's like well pre-pandemic. Now, it's got to be like almost 8 years ago.
Yeah, and it was pink. They had a lot of problems because people go, no, I don't want a rosé. No, this is Pinot Gris.
I think I scored that 5 stars,
too. It was delicious.
Yeah. So good.
And I wish we would just get off of the idea that Pinot Gris has to be, you know,
well, okay,
pale as a vampire.
I'm hoping that, like, as we've just relitigated a lot of stuff that we usually litigate on the podcast. So I'm hoping that for the people listening in the cars at home and in their homes and through your smart speakers and however you're listening to this, we brought something new to the table.
Or maybe on YouTube.
I'm
going to try and get this thing onto YouTube as well so you can find us a little easier.
So what we've got in our glass now is, I think, the highlight of what we've just tasted.
Of this tasting, yeah. It's the
The Benjamin Bridge Method Classique Brut. This is 87% Chardonnay, 13% Pinot. It's vintaged, so from 2018. So we've got so it's disgorged in May of 2023. So it's got an extra year on it since it's worked its way to our house. And
I like the toastiness here. I love the acidity here. I get a bit of
a funkiness to it.
I get a little, you know, kind of an almond note as well,
but really like orchard fruit, like Macintosh apple on the palate, like not golden delicious, more Mac.
It's as the Italians like to say, it's crispy.
It's crispy. Yeah. I've never heard Italians say that.
Oh, they say that about certain wines. They go, it's crispy. And I'm like, I don't exactly know what he means by that. But now suddenly I think I do. This is crispy. This is, when you said Mac apple, I could almost see myself biting into a Mac apple with that crispy sound when you get a good apple. So this has got a crispiness to it.
It's yummy.
Yeah.
Hey, actually, I think this is the first time that we've done this. We've literally gone coast to coast on our tasting.
Yeah. Actually, BC, Ontario. Yeah, we have.
I mean, all that's missing is really some Quebec on the table, but sadly, I don't have any. I don't have anything from Quebec in the cellar.
I don't know if Quebecers have anything Quebecers in the cellar.
I'm still standing by like the Chardonnay that I've had at I4C, like the Coteau Rougemont and Domaine Saint Jacques.
I would not to throw them under the bus, but I've had a few Quebecers on my tour. Yeah, they're not as bullish on Quebec wine as maybe they should be, or maybe not. There's a reason they come here.
There's potential there.
But
there's potential there.
Like, they are very proud of their cider. That's one thing that they'll definitely tell you. So, and their beer. Just saying.
I still think Quebec wine is worth keeping an eye on and investigating.
I'm not saying don't keep your eye on it, but I'd probably look more towards Alberta wine just as much.
Well, so this is the first one that we've done face-to-face. You've been in Italy for 2 months.
Close, yeah.
You've been in Italy for 2 months.
6 weeks.
Yeah, 6 weeks. And we did keep the lights on while you were gone. But yeah, it's good to have you back.
I'm glad to be back.
And we didn't acknowledge it on the podcast. If there's any choppiness to parts of it, it's where we had to cut out my coughs.
Yeah, what's going on with you? You had to.
So something they don't tell you when you have a child, and actually they do tell you, and you just don't believe it, is that you're not just going to get sick, you're going to get everything.
Oh.
Nobody in this house has been 100% healthy since December 26th, which was the first time we took Spencer to the doctor for respiratory sickness, and she started daycare around that time. I guess I'm
next on this list.
No, I'm not contagious. I've had this for about a week, but like, if you don't have kids, you won't believe this, but like the doctor said 10 to 13 respiratory viruses every year for the next few years.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That does not sound like fun. That's why wine was invented.
All right. I'm Andre Proof from underwinereview.ca at Andre Wine Review on the social medias. Subscribe to this podcast. Leave us a review. We haven't had any reviews in a while. So, you know, certainly feel free to leave us a review. Definitely slide into DMs to remind me or Michael whose joke is better. Cypress Hill talking about Cypress or
Crazy About a Mercury, baby.
For Mercury. Oh, yeah. You're enjoying that joke way too much. Anyways.
If I could just afford Mercury's. More, I mean. Oh, anyway, I'm Michael Pincus of MichaelPincusWineReview.com. Glad to be back on Canadian soil.
Can't believe they let you back in.
Oh, they of course let me back in. I have a Nexus card. And you find me on social media as The Grape Guy. As I said, I'm going to try and get this this podcast on YouTube. Andre doesn't believe that YouTube is a viable podcast medium.
No, I didn't say that. I just said you read me this article that said that everybody's listening to podcasts on YouTube.
I didn't say everybody. I said they're preferring it.
I don't think the numbers are as high.
So go listen to this on YouTube. Let's prove Andre wrong.
As you think.
And good night.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to Two Guys Talking Wine on iTunes.
Two Guys Talking Wine is produced by Jim Ray, Adam Duran, and Ken Little.